Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrent Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight into how it affects our national deterrence. We hope you enjoy this show.
Welcome back to another episode, a great episode. I'm confident in what we're about to produce here, but welcome back to the NIDS View. And of course, this week, it's myself, Adam Lowther, and Curtis McGiffin. Jim Petrosky is on assignment. He's probably in some adit deep in some mountain, or he's somewhere doing something important. And so he's on assignment, but Curtis is with me, and which is almost perfect, actually, because last week, Curtis and I, and then, of course, Christine and Natalie and a few other, Paul, and who am I missing?
Carrie Karchner.
Carrie was there. Oh, John Swiegel was there.
Yeah.
Jeff Larson. We had a bunch of NIDS folks that were at the StratCom Symposium. And, you know, it's always great. You know, we love the StratCom Symposium. It's kind of our Comic-Con for the nuclear folks every year, especially those, you know, with the military background. And it's a great place. We get a chance to sort of catch up with people we don't see that often. You know, you get to talk with folks about, you know, what's been going on over the last year. And, you know, you get to, you know, it's mostly a grip and grin opportunity. The panels are great. And of course, a shout out to the folks in StratCom J57, to Jamie Lassonde, and, you know, to Bill and Michael. Oh yeah, Michael Powell. Michael does a great job. Yes. You know, he has that whole symposium on his shoulders. Right. He did a great job. The J5 folks did a wonderful job this year. They've had to overcome some challenges with the venues in the past. And so they're doing a great job. They brought in great folks, great panels this year. And there was one in panel in particular that, you know, was really interesting for you and me, because it was sort of the outlier panel in the sense that Congressman John Garamondi. Nah,
before we get into that, though, Adam, let me say a few things about the symposium as well.
Okay.
You did a great job introducing everything, and it's great to be with you today and all our listeners. And yes, Jim, who is a national asset, is busy working in a super secret area in the southwest part of America, solving the world's problems and through engineering computations. And so his pocket protector is strapped on, and he is busy gonculating formulas and doing great things. And so it's a pleasure, Adam, just for you and me to chit chat about this. The Deterrence Symposium, you said it was a Comic-Con. I totally agree. I call this the Comic-Con for deterrence geeks, and this is the place to be seen, as well as to get out there and to your great observation of how well the StratCom J5 folks did in putting this together. I always try to think of the Deterrence Symposium as an opportunity to network, see old friends, and meet new ones in the midst of a sprinkling and smattering of some interesting panels.
Sure.
Yeah, and we tend to get fed pretty well, and the after parties are usually fairly interesting. And again, just getting down there. Omaha is a beautiful city. I can't get over how much it has changed in the last 15 years compared to what it was when I lived there in the 90s and early 2000s. It's just the city is just really exploded in all of its magic and the things that it is brought forth and done. So kudos to Omaha again for hosting all that, and to US StratCom for doing this symposium. I think it's extremely important that we have these get-togethers. It was an observation by somebody, one of the leaders, hosts there, I should say, that said that I think there were like 830 people or something like that in attendance.
It was the biggest one ever.
Biggest one ever. I heard that the venue filled up. They had to turn people away. That's probably a first. And the thing about it was they said that, you know, there was probably nowhere in the world were there as many thinkers in the nuclear and deterrence world as there was in those 2 days in that room to be all congregated together. So
I bet you probably didn't notice that or know this, but for 2 days in August, the convention center in Omaha was the Russians' number one nuclear target. I'm pretty confident that is true. I could be wrong, but I bet it was number one for the North Koreans and the Chinese as well.
It could be well. It might be the case. You replaced the Ground Zero Cafe in the middle of the Pentagon there, right? So for just a couple of days. Well, they missed their opportunity, and we all made it home safely. And here we are to sort of reflect and talk about it. And I do want to give a quick shout out to our great fellows who were there. And we have some fellows that are a part of STRATCOM, Jen Bradley and other folks who were there.
Right.
We ran into Dylan Land and Jacob Blank and other folks out there. So there were a lot of people. And also a shout out to Missouri State School of Defense and Strategic Studies
Gary Geipel was there.
So they were doing a lot of great things recruiting for that most excellent program. It was just an all around, I think, great event in that regard. But as you were starting to lead into, Adam, you know, there were a lot of great panels, and I don't think we're going to bore the listeners with sort of reviewing each panel. I think eventually they'll all be posted on the internet so people can watch them.
The video should be up in a month or so.
Yeah. So again, I want to thank everybody for all the hard work they did and for our NIDS fellows who were there. The last thing I'll say here, Adam, before we sort of move on to our topic is, you know, while you were eating bagels and shaking hands, I was busy pulsing the people who were attending, trying to figure out, how well do you know NIDS? Have you heard of us? Are we on their radar? You know, the big fish, right, who are in the big FFRDCs and the big think tanks and corporations, have they heard of us? Are we starting to make a splash after 2 years? And the answer is yes. I was very happily surprised, maybe I shouldn't be, but I was, how many folks actually had heard of us, who maybe have heard a podcast or read one of our articles or had been engaged in one of our presentations or attended a talk that you've given or I've given or anybody else on our team have given. So we're definitely getting out there as far as notoriety, for lack of a better term. And I think that's not only good for us and those who are interested in us, but I like to think that we're actually starting to make a difference out there as we begin to argue in favor of what we believe is really helping to foster peace and stability in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. And it's, you know, it sort of leads into our topic that I want to move to, because it was sort of I don't know if we want to say the highlight. It was sort of certainly the most interesting part of the conference. And this was, you know, STRATCOM is pretty good about trying to, you know, they're pretty balanced and they want to get differing perspectives and differing views. And so they put folks on the panels who don't necessarily agree, who are internationals, you know, so you had Australians and Brits and, you know, you have allies and partners who have a panel, and it's always really interesting to hear from the allies and how they think about issues and what they want to see from the United States. And they had Congressman Garamondi, a Democrat from California. And he's been one of the staunchest opponents. He's a very clear disarmament advocate. And he would like to see the cancellation of the Sentinel program and the retirement of Minuteman III. And he would like to move down to a dyad of bombers and submarines and, you know, of course, ultimately move to a monad and then eventually disarmament. And so he gave a talk. And he talked about, you know, eliminating Sentinel and then shared some of his own views about, you know, why do we do what we do? And I thought that was sort of a great segue into a discussion on some of these topics. So, you know, we've got transcripts. The transcript we'll post Garamondi's transcript on the when we post the podcast. So look for the a link to it. But you've read it and you remember the talk. What was your take on what the congressman said?
Well, you know, first of all, Congressman Garamondi serves. He's a Democrat, California 8th District, which is just right in the San Francisco Bay Area. Travis Air Force Base falls in his district, I believe, and that's sort of his connection. He serves on the House Armed Services Committee, and more importantly, he serves on the Strategic Forces Subcommittee, which is why he cares about Sentinel and nukes in general. So I just want to point that out.
What you're saying is that he should know better then, because he's on the committee that, and the subcommittee in particular, that matters.
Yeah, I don't profess to understand how every congressman gets assigned to which committee, other than, you know, I generally assume that you know, Congress people who are from the Midwest are more interested in the agricultural committees than maybe the ones from, you know, the coastlines and, sure, you know, and these sorts of things. If you're from Texas or Oklahoma, you might be more interested in energy committees. And clearly, if you've got military bases or a large amount of defense industry in your district, you tend to want to be interested in the House Armed Services Committee. Others are just interested in these things. They become senior within the House and sort of make their way into these committees by virtue of their seniority and the fact that they've been around long enough. Or maybe they've formerly served on the Intelligence Committee and now they want to just get into the military side on the, you know, on the House Armed Services. So the, you know, how they get there is, you know, a myriad of reasons, I'm sure. But of course, you know, we tend to want to think that nuclear deterrence is somewhat nonpartisan. You know, it's hard pressed for me to agree with that observation, especially after this particular presentation. And to listen to the congressman, you don't really, in my mind's eye, I didn't really get to appreciate what he said sitting in that room with 800 people. And Adam, you and I were standing in the back, so we were a huge distance away. Reading the transcript is what was really enlightening. And then I'll say this. The comments that I heard after, when that panel was finished and everybody came out into the foyer to, you know, grab a soda, use the restroom and chit chat about what they just heard. I had a lot of people, you know, at least comment to me or that I overheard commenting to someone else, not necessarily agreeing with the good congressman. So, you know, I'm not sure that his presentation made a whole lot of sense into the ears in that room, but I think he felt like it had to be said. What sure, I want to spend a sure, few minutes on with you, Adam, is sort of debating a couple of the points within his presentation, because I think he just fundamentally misunderstands some things here. And I don't want to be overly, you know, assumptive here that he doesn't know these things. I think he does. I think is his choice to follow in these different directions.
Well, let's start first with, you know, a distinction that I think has to be made. You have two camps. You have realist, and I would submit that the vast majority of sort of the pro-nuke crowd are realists who accept the world for the way that it is. They probably believe that human nature is imperfect. You know, they hold some sort of Judeo-Christian view of the world that, you know, we're all fallen creatures and we're fundamentally wicked, that kind of a thing. And then you, I would submit a lot of people, and I won't say every or all, but a lot who are in the disarmament community are idealists. And idealists believe that human nature can be shaped if you have the right institutions, and those right institutions get a hold of, you know, all little children, and then they teach them the right values, then we can eliminate crime and poverty and the need for nuclear weapons and war. And this is all doable. It's just, we just have to have the right institutions, the right policies, the right values, and we got to make sure that they're all inculcated. And this is what Lenin used to talk about, Soviet man. And that if you could create the Soviet man, then you could get rid of greed, and you could get rid of avarice, and you could get rid of all these things. And then, everybody, from each according to his ability, to each according to his need, and you could have this utopian society. And I would submit to you that Garamondi lives in a world in which the overriding thing for him are his aspirations. And for advocates of a large and overweening government, I would submit that they care about intentions as opposed to outcomes. Because the one thing that you can say about nuclear deterrence is that it's worked for 70 plus years. I mean, it has. It's worked. But if you're idealistic, you care about the world you want rather than the world that is.
Right.
And you judge people based on their intentions, not based on the outcomes of their actions. And I think that's sort of a foundational thing you have to set when you want to talk about, why does the congressman say the things and believe the things he does? It's because this is sort of at his core is worldview.
Mm-hmm.
And worldviews shape how and what we do.
So to add to that, Keith Payne wrote some books on this. He's been talking about this idea of easy deterrence and difficult deterrence and easy deterrence. I'm sorry. And that's sort of the realist look of how nuclear deterrence works. And an idealist view in the nuclear deterrence problem as something that is about disarmament. Idealists believe that nuclear weapons are inherently evil and are the cause of potential Holocaust rather than the prevention of potential Holocaust, and that their very existence is the risk. And essentially, idealists believe that that the disarmament movement is what will cause the transformation into what you just described in this idealistic kind of world. Realists, on the other hand, who do understand the balance of power and accept that in this self-help world, sort of say, well, look, deterrence is necessary because the alternative is war, because disarmament isn't something that's possible. And by the way, the idealists don't like deterrence because they view deterrence, particularly nuclear deterrence, as putting nuclear weapons in a positive light. So that's why they don't generally support deterrence or the concept or theory of deterrence when they're thinking about nuclear weapons. On the realist side, they think about deterrence as, am I a maximist or a minimalist? And so the minimalists believe you just need a few, that everything works, everybody behaves prudently and predictably, and therefore deterrence will never fail, so you don't need a whole bunch of other things to go with it. And I think the world is just fundamentally not in that direction. And so when we look at Congressman Garamondi's comments here, and we'll pick out a few here that are particularly interesting to me. And right here in the beginning, he says here, we must avoid blind adherence to yesterday's decisions. Are we talking about yesterday's decisions of a new start and the fact that we're trying to maintain a treaty that the Russians don't want to be in, or that we're trying to maintain nuclear numbers in a world that was devised when these numbers were devised, they were 18 years ago? Whatever the case may be. I mean, that world does not exist anymore.
Well, my question is, why does the fact that we support having nuclear weapons mean that we're stuck in the Cold War? That's sort of a straw man argument that is constantly thrown at those of us that believe nuclear weapons have a place.
Right.
Is that, well, you're stuck in the Cold War. If you don't want to get rid of all nuclear weapons, you are inherently stuck in the previous century.
And that, in a sense, is the old thinking. That is the old thinking that he is trying to tell us to stop doing. And you got to expect these things. He said that Putin has used irresponsible nuclear threats to try to prevent the support of the Ukrainian people, essentially nuclear weapons to deter non-nuclear aggression. And then he says, of course, no one has used these weapons yet. Well, that's a fundamental misunderstanding. Putin has used his weapons, as stated in the previous paragraph by the congressman, to prevent American, coerce American support towards or against, however you want to couch it, the Ukrainian conflict.
And he's done a great job, by the way.
Well, he has.
He's been highly successful.
That is correct. So the United States has been successfully deterred, not completely, but we have not been allowed complete freedom of movement to support the Ukrainian war, as some people might argue. He notes here that they're just proponents often justify nuclear weapons for two reasons. One, to deter and fight a strategic nuclear exchange between major powers. So that's not one, that's two. And then he says for the second one, to deter non-nuclear aggression. And I would argue he's missed two other reasons. One of them is the enforcement of strategic stability, right? America is a superpower because of its nuclear capability. It is the reason why other nations seek nuclear weapons, is to achieve a seat at the table, if you will. And then the other one is So enforcing and maintaining that status quo, that rules-based order that we keep talking about in podcasts and hear about in the news, that China and Russia are trying to upend. It is America's nuclear deterrent that seeks to do that. I remind our listeners that America is the only nation in the free world that has a strategic bomber and a strategic intercontinental ballistic missile. And finally, there is actually a fifth purpose for our nuclear deterrence, and that is to enforce or enhance or encourage nonproliferation. Because if we get rid of ours, the allies are going to get theirs. And so if you are a believer in nonproliferation, and I presume Congressman Garamondi is, eliminating America's nuclear, even a portion of it, is not going to encourage the allies to continue to be a non-proliferant. And so it's almost counterintuitive to his argument. He also goes on to talk about the cost. He makes a mention in his presentation that over the next 30 years, we will spend almost $2 trillion on our nuclear weapons. I think the real number is, even with Nunn McCurdy, is now somewhere 1.5, 1.7. That's a far cry from two. But if we want to make that sort of 30-year argument, let's remind the listeners that costs of living and inflation has gone up 20% in the last 3.5 years. And that's a tremendous amount of increase just off the top. And the final thing I'll say in a counter argument to that is, okay, well, I would argue that we're going to spend $30 trillion over those next 30 years buying and building and maintaining a conventional warfare arsenal that will actually be used to kill people and regime change and enforce national interests or whatever the case may be, however you want to couch it, real warfighting material that will kill and spend money. We're going to spend a lot more than $2 trillion over 30 years on that stuff. And our argument is how about we spend less on that and maybe a little more on the stuff that keeps peace and stability? Thoughts?
Yeah, no, I'm with you. It's this, sometimes I wonder if it's a willful misrepresentation and a willful misunderstanding, because if you don't set up straw men and you don't misrepresent what others say, then you can't try to, you know, argue for your feelings. And, you know, in the end, disarmament is about feelings. It's not about facts. Because I'm constantly, you know, and the, you know, I wish they would just come out and say, hey, your facts do not get in the way of my feelings.
That's right. That's right.
And just be upfront about it, because they, you know, Garamondi says, and I hear this all the time, that ICBMs are destabilizing. And I'm like, okay, well, if that's your premise, show me the facts. What evidence do you have?
Right.
Do you have evidence from the Russians? Do you have, are the Chinese? I mean, what evidence do you have? It's just sort of a, these are not the droids you're looking for kind of hand wave. Mm-hmm. And we're supposed to say, oh, well, you said they're destabilizing, therefore they must be. But they're not destabilizing. You know, there's no evidence that says that the Russians are saying, man, we got to shoot today. Who knows how this could go tonight because of the very existence of ICBMs.
Right. And he goes on to, he comments in here in his lecture, his speech about this, or the comments he made on the panel, that, you know, why are these ground-based ICBMs necessary? These missiles sit in their silos not too far from you in the heart of America. Those locations are known to cowhands, sheep herders, and the targeting personnel in the bunkers of our adversaries. Well, you know what? I'm glad they know where they are, because I would much rather their systems be landing on not in our cities, per se.
Yeah.
And so he say, if in a nuclear crisis, China and Russia choose to deploy a counterforce strategy, they will launch early to destroy those missiles in the locations that are known. Yes, if that's the case. And that, and if they're destroyed in place, that is a political decision not to launch on warning in retaliation. In a policy that America has not had, but has always been able to do for decades. Let me stress again, the United States does not and has not had a policy of launch on warning. And what I would argue here is that the good congressman says it's a bad thing that they know where they are, and that if they decide to go first to destroy them in place, that that would be a bad thing. And my argument is if they're spending 2 to 3 of their warheads on each one of our silos to ensure that we can't strike them back, those are warheads that aren't landing on cities. And if they are landing on warheads in Montana, and other Midwestern states in the world, fooey on politicians who decide to let them be destroyed in place, and rather than exact the threat that was poised, that makes deterrence work. The decision to let them to die is a political decision made by America, not by the Russians or the Chinese.
Yeah. One thing that I kind of wish we could effectively convey, which for whatever reason, we've never been able to effectively convey this. And it's this, you know, there's this constant desire. We need to go from 1500 to 1000 to 500. And, you know, I've mentioned this before on this podcast, and that's the idea of, you know, that during Vietnam, the Vietnam conflict, it took about 56,000 rounds of small arms ammunition to kill one, you know, NVA soldier, one Viet Cong soldier. And then you told me, and I had never seen the numbers before.
Sent you the links.
You sent me the links and the numbers, you know, surprisingly, and maybe the listeners will find this surprising, in the war in Iraq
and Afghanistan, you know,
and Afghanistan that started after 2003, we actually expended 250,000 rounds for every one, you know, jihadist that we killed, one Taliban, one. So we had to shoot a lot more small arms rounds, you know, 5 times as many to kill one. And so when you're having to expend, the country that expends 250,000 rounds to kill one person, why do we believe that we can have, you know, 100 or 500 nuclear weapons, and that those weapons, every single one of them, is going to leave a silo, leave a sub, you know, leave an aircraft, and it's going to go and hit the exact target? They're never going to get shot down. They're never going to fail the launch. They're never going to miss a target. None of that's ever going to happen. So we need to pick, you know, 100 or 500 targets and then have one weapon for each target, because nothing bad is ever going to happen. That's something that clearly demonstrates to me that people don't fundamentally understand warfare. That's why, in some respects, I wish we would quit talking about nuclear weapons as deterrence. I personally hate it when people talk about nuclear weapons and deterrence. Nuclear weapons don't exist to deter. Nuclear weapons exist to fight and win a war. The happy byproduct of that preparation to fight and win a war is deterrence. It's a byproduct that I am very thankful we have. But nuclear weapons exist to fight and destroy and win a war. And so we need to think about fighting and winning and of course, let deterrence become that byproduct. And then you stop thinking about it in terms of these arbitrary numbers.
Right. Well, I would say that's a very interesting way to think about this problem set here.
Do you disagree with me, Curtis?
I don't necessarily disagree. I think that for deterrence to work, Herman Kahn said that the best way to look willing is to be willing. And so if we're going to talk about preparation for deterrence is a byproduct of a preparation for war. When you think about conventional deterrence, it is exactly the same philosophy. The problem is it's much more expensive. So
it is.
And it's much more provocative because it's much more usable. So let me move on here. He goes on to ask the question, sort of rhetorically, I guess, to the audience is why do we have a triad? And again, this gets to his idea of why do we keep thinking about this in the old way that a strategy cannot afford to be stagnant. It's a quote. And I would agree with him. I think the idea of why do we need a triad, even though this is a question that has been asked and answered by all the previous presidents since 1992, and even up to the current one in President Biden, all have validated the need and the benefit of a strategic triad. The adversaries are all building versions of triads because they see the value in it. But my point here is we actually need a quadrat, not a triad, right? And what's the quadrat, you ask, Adam? Go ahead and ask me.
What is a quadrat?
A quadrat is when we add a fourth leg, and that would be a mobile leg. Now, the Russians and the Chinese have a quadrat, even though we call it a triad, because they have mobile versions. Mobile ICBMs present a new targeting challenge to the adversary. It is more difficult to deter because it is harder to hold at risk those weapons in a counterforce strategy. And it is a problem that we have unburdened the adversary from because we don't possess them. And so we make it easier on them. Every time we do these sorts of things, we make it easier for them to hold us at risk. And then therefore, Adam, coerce us into not doing things or giving up on allies in certain regions of the country or not being present or enforcing our own national interests when it conflicts with theirs. And so that's just the answer. That is the question that needs the answer. And that is, if you want to do national security, and you want to do it geopolitically, what are you going to do? Carrier battle groups were designed to be, 5 acres of sovereign U.S. territory, right, floating around on each carrier and all these great things. They're expensive. They have a lot of people. I'll remind you, Adam, that I don't believe, save the Marine Corps, none of our services have met their recruiting goals for the last 3 or 4 years. How would we ever man a greater conventional force of size? And is it possible that if we had more nuclear weapons, we could therefore have fewer people? That we could solve a recruiting problem?
The great thing about your mobile, and I agree, and I also agree with you that a fourth leg of the triad, a mobile leg, should be an air-based leg in which ICBMs are dropped out of the back of C-5 Galaxies. I agree with that. And I also believe that it should include, as part of this mobile leg, hypersonic weapons dropped out of the back C-130s. That would be, because we don't want to run ICBMs around, on America's rail lines or on America's highways. So we're going to fly them around.
I would propose putting these things, in these huge, the federal government owns owns majority land, federal lands in Western states that are bigger than what the states own. There's plenty of land to run these things around, and the American population might not ever see them. And they'd still be able to be mobile and hide around. But your idea is interesting. Talk about innovation, to create another air leg, right? But then you're going to have to
absolutely
ensure anybody who's flown the C-5 knows that they're prone to having some challenges. And so we would have to make sure that their ability to fly on demand is ready to go.
Or let's just buy some new Boeings. I've heard they make great planes. So let's buy some new Boeings and we'll put them in there.
Yeah.
And I mean, could you imagine flying right around and dropping MIRVed, dumping ICBM Sentinels with, you know, 5 or 6 warheads out of the back of, you know, a new right Boeing aircraft, and doing it from over the Atlantic or, you know, over Canada or someplace where they would never expect it to come from? It really would complicate the defense and the targeting of the right Russians and the Chinese.
Well, it changes the dynamic where we don't have to build our own nuclear torpedoes like the Russian Poseidon. We would have a different way to counter their surprise capability. And the whole purpose of this, Adam, is to create a sense of fear in the adversary that is enough, that is intolerable enough that they will actually come to the negotiating table and find a way to go down. Because right now they're not interested. So let me go to the last quote that I want to close this out with, because I know we are running out of time. And that is here that Congressman closes his presentation out with, what national victory could we or our adversaries ever hope to achieve at the end of a nuclear war that inevitably kills hundreds of millions of people, including tens of millions of Americans, destroys entire cities, and endangers the environment of the planet? All right. So let's take a moment, right, to dissect that statement. All right. The humorous side of me would say that if we want to solve global warming, a nuclear winter might help. But that's just true to say in jest, because morbid humor sometimes is enjoyed by our audience. But let me take it this farther. The whole idea here is they're holding us hostage and we hold them hostage with those capabilities. That is a Thomas Schelling terminology that has existed since the 1960s. Okay, so I'm not saying anything that's out of the ordinary here. But let me ask you this. Now, I believe that the American leadership, whether it be any one of the presidents who have already served or any of those who are currently running to take over in the office in 2025, none of them would take any pleasure in killing Russians, Chinese, or North Koreans. Would you agree with me?
Yes, I would. Okay. I don't even think.
So why is it that we think that Putin, who America and the rest of the world has declared a war criminal, or Z, who enslaves people and encamps them, or KJU, who does much of the same and is willing to immiserate his population in any way possible in order to secure whatever nuclear capabilities he needs, would have some sort of altruistic desire to protect American lives? When we look at autocracies and the way they treat their internal populations, we must measure their compassion in that manner. And so we must never be willing to cede our safety and security to the compassions of the adversaries I just described. And I think it's intellectually dishonest to assume that they care more about us than they do about their own people. And I just think it's a bridge too far to believe that they would ever give up a perceived advantage over us, especially when our own leaders, elected leaders, want to enhance that perceived superiority or advantage over us by eliminating a leg of the triad.
All right. Well, we've run long, so we have got to go ahead and end the show. So good points. It was thanks to Congressman Garamondi for giving us fodder for today's episode.
I respect him a lot. I appreciate his point of view. I disagree with it immensely, but that does not mean that his point of view should not be shared. But I think it should be challenged. And I hope that's what we did a little bit today.
Yeah. And thanks to you, the listeners, of course, for joining us on this episode of the NIDS View. Of course, check out our website. We've got all the podcasts and articles. Go to Global Security Review. If you want to listen to interviews with senior leaders, check out my podcast, NucleCast, over at the Anwan Deterrence Center. Curtis is tweeting or Xing on
whatever you want to call that.
Yeah, he puts good articles up every day. So check us out on our social media and all of the places you can check us out. And of course, you know, if you want to sign up for the NIDS Academy, or you know, we're working on some degree programs and partnering with some universities. So we'll have more on that for you soon. So stay engaged. Thanks for listening. And as always, we want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.